Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting through our studios in New York City. But because I'm in the final days of filming a very important documentary, not in the studio actually where I can be filmed myself, we're going to talk today about Generation X at greater risk of a stroke than their parents or grandparents, Rutgers University. From the University of Missouri, can a common probiotic reduce the stress levels and lessen anxiety? Also, eat lots of fiber or the microbes we eat your colon, University of Michigan. What does that mean? Doesn't sound good. It isn't. And breast cancer eats, it sleeps, then it wakes up, and it grows, and it kills you. Texas A&M University, and this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Important, and I'll explain what it means. High heat increases heart disease risk, University of Edinburgh, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, we're going to take a look at the millennial generation from a different perspective. One of the most articulate spokespersons for that generation will give about a 14-minute discussion, a commentary on the best and worst that they are and what they need to do to get it right. I have then found an old piece, an old audio clip from Jack Webb of the Dragnet television series from the early 60s. And I think you'll find it very similar to what we're seeing today. Also today, Professor Mary Holland, who is a professor of law, who was inside New York University Medical School, where the pro-vaccine individuals, including Dr. Paul Offit, were talking about how we should go after the exemptions and any of the people who are advocating for a challenge to vaccines. She's going to tell us what happened inside, her perspective. I will explain what happened outside from my perspective and why the entire vaccine movement must change direction. It is terribly misguided at this moment. Well-intentioned, yes, misguided in its tools for change. Also, Robert Kennedy Jr., you will hear his brief discussion of his conversations that he recorded of Paul Offit and the contradictions between what Offit said when Robert Kennedy corrected him about his misstatements on vaccine safety, but what then Offit turned right around and said on NPR. You'll also hear an individual who approached Paul Offit while he was waiting to go on. This was in a public space, and it was Joshua Coleman, and asked him, is he up for an interview? Simple, honest question. And Paul Offit's response, very inappropriate, we'll play that. So we have all that on vaccines, and then I wanted to offer my own commentary today about what I believe is wrong when we take it upon ourselves to use different excuses like holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, to just massively engage in gluttony, purchasing, materialism. All that we do not need actually works against us. And I've coined a new term today I'll be sharing with you. And what it means compared to other ocracies. And I'm going to give a philosophical, historical look at some of the greatest philosophers in history of how we could use their insights today. So as you see, we have a packed show. Let's begin. We're all concerned about Generation X because the older baby boomers, those born between 1945 and 54, can, according to Rutgers University, proudly boast a new label, the stroke healthiest generation. That's what the study has found, that they had the lowest incidence of ischemic stroke in this age group within the past 20 years. Now, we can certainly understand why, because that's the generation that's most likely to read, is most likely to be looking at parents or in-laws who are suffering from the consequences of not being healthy, and hence the movement to Let's start to eat right. Let's start to exercise. Let's start to do the yoga and jog or power walk. and therefore they're actually coming down in a lot of the numbers. They're not as sick. But that's not true for their children. Contrast that to the rate of stroke that more than doubled among their children, the Generation X. People born between 1965 and 1974. The study was just published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. Quote, the incidence of stroke has decreased significantly overall since 1950 due to the advancements of medicine, end quote. Yeah, you think so? I don't. I would hold a different opinion. First of all, that is not true, in my opinion, because having a stroke and then taking aspirin may prevent another stroke, but it also contributes to heart disease and elevated homocysteine and C-reactive protein levels. But by looking at what you know can contribute to heart disease through your lifestyle, that, especially in a highly educated group that actually uses education in a good way. So we should be spending more time advocating with our children for lifestyle modification. Let's just get them to do the things that can help prevent a stroke. For example, let's say they won't change their diet, and be realistic, most people will not change their diet, even when faced with dire consequences, will not change their diet. But if we could get them to have a green juice once a day, to have some magnesium, let's say 800 milligrams of magnesium citrate, to have a high heat unit cayenne pepper, to have 200 to 300 milligrams of coenzyme Q10, you could put all this into a smoothie form. That will lower their incidence of a stroke because that naturally thins the blood. The more garlic and onion you eat, the thinner your blood, the less likelihood of a stroke. From University of Missouri, common probiotics, that's the good bacteria, can reduce stress levels and lessen anxiety. And it talks about what they found in this study on the lactobacillus. And that's important. So here's the takeaway message. When you take in the probiotics, let's say you have a yogurt and a dairy yogurt, non-dairy yogurt, but that has good bacteria. You have sauerkraut, that is good bacteria. Miso, tempeh, good bacteria. That reduces the body's internal stress level. And that reduces anxiety. From University of Michigan, eat lots of fiber or the microbes will eat your colon. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell. And it has implications for understanding not only the role of fiber in a normal diet, but also the potential of using fiber to counter the effects of digestive tract disorders. Quote, the lesson we've learned from studying the interaction of fiber, gut microbes, and intestinal barrier system is that if you don't feed them, they can eat you. That's according to Professor Mike Biology. And what they're saying is this. I'll put it in a very basically language. We have an intestine that helps break down a lot of the food products that we eat so it can be absorbed. That's where your nutrients actually get absorbed. And that's also where the body purges the dead cells, the dead bacteria, and the different fibers and throws them out of the body as fecal matter. When you're eating sugar, you're feeding the bad bacteria. Meat, alcohol, the same. Chemicals, the same. But when you start eating a clean, healthy diet, rich in fruits and vegetables, you're feeding good bacteria. And the good bacteria then are dominant in the intestine, the colon, and that means then you're going to get less challenges to that area of the body that are destructive, less inflammation, healthier digestion, better absorption. From Texas A&M University, as published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, breast cancer eats, sleeps, then wakes up and grows. Well, scientists have long puzzled over how breast cancer can suddenly reappear, often with a vengeance, months or even years after treatment is complete. Now researchers have discovered these dormant tumor cells might have become latent because they cannibalized, basically ate the other body's own stem cells. The team has been working on teaching adult stem cells from bone marrow called the MSC to fight cancer when they noticed that the MSCs were disappearing from the cell cultures. Quote, we actually thought we had made a mistake or were missing an anomaly or negative result. But we eventually realized that the breast cancer cells were eating the stem cells. What was really interesting was what was happening next. The breast cancer cells that had taken in the stem cells went dormant, essentially becoming sleepy, but at the same time, they became much more difficult to kill. The scientists realized that if breast cancer cells in the body behave the same, it might explain cancer reoccurrence. I would have a completely different take on this. Not that what they're suggesting isn't true at the cellular level, it probably is, and that's good research. But here's what I have found. Working with people, working with tens of thousands of women with health conditions, many of them with breast cancer, many of them will come, and the story is always the same. 99.9% of all the people I see have gone through orthodox treatment. They've gone through the surgery, radiation and chemotherapy, and that shrunk the tumor. They might have to go through another session, 3 to 6 months later, but then a year later, year and a half later, they're cancer-free. They're called in remission. And then they feel great. Then more often than not, they go back to many of their old habits. They lose that sense of focus. If they had that focus, because almost never are you taught the right way to build your immune system from orthodox medicine. You're taught that it's all in your genes, and you just happen to have the bad genes, but medicine's done the best it can get it out of you. So imagine then that you don't change anything that caused the initial immune system to falter to begin with. So now, a year, 2, 3 years later, your immune system is not strong. You have not fed it. So now the immune system begins to weaken. And then at a point in time when your immune system is so weakened, it triggers an energy transfer to awaken those cells that no longer have any concern they're going to dominate, and hence the ravages of a second breast cancer eruption. The trouble is, the second time around, they may be able to do some surgery, maybe not. They'll try some radiation or chemotherapy, but almost always that fails, and the person succumbs. More often than not, at least 50% of the time, the person is succumbing to the treatment, not the cancer. So what we should be doing is, without cancer, we should be building our immune system as if we had it. With cancer, we should focus nonstop on our body until we no longer have it, and then boost it. I call it the laws of compensation, which means to the degree that you have any disorder, whether it's due to genetics, trauma, electromagnetic influences, nutritional deficiencies, viruses, bacteria, parasites, you must exceed by a substantial margin the pathogenicity of the disease with the healing. So if you just ate an orange, that might give you 30 to 40 milligrams of vitamin C, but you need about 15,000 milligrams of vitamin C if you're healthy to stay healthy. The trouble is, we have very few people who are healthy in the United States, very few, under 5%. The rest are all processing disease. So when the disease finally tips the person where they can no longer manifest the quality of life, they're already 85% towards death. So that last 15%, almost everything it's done, contributes to their dying process. The medicines with their side effects, the chemotherapy, which is carcinogenic, the radiation, which is carcinogenic and immunosuppressive, all these destroy the body. So by taking in not an orange to get your vitamin C, which is what your average doctor will tell you, but rather taking large doses throughout the day, then you are protecting the cells. You're keeping the immune systems very vigilant, let's say 30 to 40 different microbes in the body that are part of your immune system, like T cells, B cells, macrophages. You're keeping them fully functional. By giving extra vitamin C each day, you're also strengthening the natural killer cells, which are better able to find and destroy cancer cells in the body. Now, we still do not know the completeness of this, but if you're constantly strong, if your immune system is constantly being supported, then you have a much longer period before any pathogen can manifest itself. Now, why that is, we cannot absolutely explain it, but the fact that in every single healthy person, there's a much longer latency period proves the point. Once again, reality always supersedes scientific verification. Life is not validated by science. Science has its own set of validating points, to which science is barely one of the indicators. So the takeaway message is, keep the foods, the juices, the supplements, the exercises, the stress management coming into your system every day that keeps your immune system strong. And finally, from University of Edinburgh, this is high heat in cooking increases heart disease. Quote, cooking at a high temperature may raise the risk of heart disease due to toxic chemicals being released. Now, a recent study warns that cooking food at a high temperature may increase the risk of developing heart disease. And this is due to the toxic chemicals created in foods when cooked on high heat. This research was also carried out to explore why some ethnicities are more apt to develop heart disease than others. And when food is cooked at high temperatures, let's say higher than 150 degrees centigrade, it modifies the chemical structure and can produce toxic products known as neoform contaminants. And trans fatty acids are formed when oils break down as a result of foods being fried at high temperatures, like your corn oil, canola oil, sunflower, safflower seed oil, soy oil, and that's what they use in a lot of these products. And that creates these harmful toxins, what are called advanced glycation end products. So the University of Edinburgh led an international team and performed a review of previous studies that explored the effects of these particular contaminants, these neo-formed contaminants, on animal and human tissue. They also investigated the relationship between them and heart disease risk. And sure enough, the takeaway message, the more foods that you consume that were cooked at high temperatures, the more likely you are to die of a heart attack. So, and yesterday a friend called while I was writing some commentaries and said, why don't you turn on the TV and watch this? There's a show about carnival food. I'd never heard of it. So I turned it on, and sure enough, there's this guy going around praising and yum-yum-yumming all this carnival food. In my opinion, the most unhealthy food imaginable. But there's all these people, none of them healthy, chomping on this stuff like it was just, this is on their bucket list while they're still alive. They want to eat all this stuff all the time. Well, that's all deep fried. In fact, almost all the food that you see presented on all the cooking programs, in my personal opinion, is the food that destroys your health. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Tomorrow, I'll be up in at 7 o'clock in Woodstock and at the View Studio on Mountain View Avenue to premiere my new film. And on Sunday at noon, my one and only New York showing, until we do a fundraiser for the station, will be at the Cinema Arts Center. If you want to join me, I'll be there for the new film, Plant Codes. Call 631-423-7610, 631-423-7610. Now, let's hear from a gentleman, young guy, who has something to say about millennials, his own generation. I think you'll find it interesting.
Millennial question. Apparently, millennials as a generation, which is a group of people who were born approximately 1984 and after, are tough to manage. And they're accused of being entitled and narcissistic and self-interested unfocused, lazy, but entitled is the big one. And because they confound leadership so much, what's happening is leaders are asking the millennials, what do you want? And millennials are saying, we want to work in a place with purpose, love that. We want to make an impact, you know, whatever that means. We want free food and beanbags. And so somebody articulates some sort of purpose. There's lots of free food and there's beanbags, and yet for some reason, they're still not happy. And that's because they're missing, there's a missing piece. What I've learned is that I can break it down into four pieces, right? There are four things, four characteristics. One is parenting, the other one is technology, the third is impatience, and the fourth is environment. The generation that we call the millennials, too many of them grew up subject to, not my words, failed parenting strategies, you know, where, for example, they were told that they were special all the time. They were told that they could have anything they want in life just because they want it, right? They were told, some of them got into honors classes not because they deserved it, but because their parents complained. And some of them got A's not because they earned them, but because the teachers didn't want to deal with the parents. Some kids got participation medals. They got a medal for coming in last, right? Which the science we know is pretty clear, which is it devalues the medal and the reward for those who actually work hard, and it actually makes the person who comes in last feel embarrassed because they know they didn't deserve it, so it actually makes them feel worse, right? So you take this group of people, and they graduate school, and they get a job, and they're thrust into the real world, and in an instant, they find out they're not special, their moms can't get them a promotion, that you get nothing for coming in last, and by the way, you can't just have it because you want it. Right? And in an instant, their entire self-image is shattered. And so you have an entire generation that's growing up with lower self-esteem than previous generations. The other problem, to compound it, is we're growing up in a Facebook, Instagram world. In other words, we're good at putting filters on things. We're good at showing people that life is amazing even though I'm depressed. Right? And so everybody sounds tough, and everybody sounds like they got it all figured out. And the reality is there's very little toughness, and most people don't have it figured out. And so when the more senior people say, well, what should we do? They sound like, this is what you got to do. And they have no clue. Right? So you have an entire generation growing up with lower self-esteem than previous generations, right? Through no fault of their own. Through no fault of their own, right? They were dealt a bad hand, right? Now let's add in technology. We know that engagement with social media and our cell phones releases a chemical called dopamine. That's why when you get a text, it feels good, right? So, you know, we've all had it where you're feeling a little bit down or feeling a bit lonely, and so you send out 10 texts to 10 friends, you know, hi, 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 because it feels good when you get a response, right? Right? It's why we count the likes. It's why we go back 10 times to see if my Instagram is growing slower. Did I do something wrong? Do they not like me anymore? Right? The trauma for young kids to be unfriended, right? Because we know when you get a hit of dopamine, which feels good. It's why we like it. It's why we keep going back to it. Dopamine is the exact same chemical that makes us feel good when we smoke, when we drink, and when we gamble. In other words, it's highly, highly addictive. Right? We have age restrictions on smoking, gambling, and alcohol, and we have no age restrictions on social media and cell phones, which is the equivalent of opening up the liquor cabinet and saying to our teenagers, hey, by the way, this adolescence thing, if it gets you down. But that's basically what's happening. That's basically what's happening, right? That's basically what happened. You have an entire generation that has access to an addictive, numbing chemical called dopamine through social media and cell phones as they're going through the high stress of adolescence. Why is this important? Almost every alcoholic discovered alcohol when they were teenagers. When we're very, very young, the only approval we need is the approval of our parents. And as we go through adolescence, we make this transition where we now need the approval of our peers. Very frustrating for our parents, very important for us. It allows us to acculturate outside of our immediate families into the broader tribe. Right? It's a highly, highly stressful and anxious period of our lives, and we're supposed to learn to rely on our friends. Some people, quite by accident, discover alcohol and numbing effects of dopamine to help them cope with the stresses and anxieties of adolescence. Unfortunately, that becomes hardwired in their brains. And for the rest of their lives, when they suffer significant stress, they will not turn to a person, they will turn to the bottle. Social stress, financial stress, career stress, that's pretty much the primary reasons why an alcoholic drinks, right? What's happening is because we're allowing unfettered access to these dopamine-producing devices and media, basically it's becoming hardwired, and what we're seeing is as they grow older, too many kids don't know how to form deep, meaningful relationships. Their words, not mine. They will admit that many of their friendships are superficial. They will admit that their friends, that they don't count on their friends, they don't rely on their friends, they have fun with their friends, but they also know that their friends will cancel on them if something better comes along. Deep, meaningful relationships are not there because they never practice the skill set, and worse, they don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress. So when significant stress starts to show up in their lives, they're not turning to a person, they're turning to a device, they're turning to social media, they're turning to these things which offer temporary relief. We know, the science is clear, we know that people who spend more time on Facebook suffer higher rates of depression than people who spend less time on Facebook. Right? These things balanced. Alcohol is not bad. Too much alcohol is bad. Gambling is fun. Too much gambling is dangerous. Right? There's nothing wrong with social media and cell phones. It's the imbalance. Right? If you're sitting at dinner with your friends and you're texting somebody who's not there, that's a problem. That's an addiction. If you're sitting in a meeting with people you're supposed to be listening to and speaking and you put your phone on the table, face up or face down, I don't care, that sends a subconscious message to the room that you're just not that important to me right now, right? That's what happens. And the fact that you cannot put it away is because you are addicted, right? If you wake up and you check your phone before you say good morning to your girlfriend, boyfriend, or spouse, you have an addiction. And like all addiction, in time, it'll destroy relationships, it'll cost time, and it'll cost money, and it'll make your life worse, right? So you have a generation growing up with lower self-esteem that doesn't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress. Right? Now you add in the sense of impatience. Right? They've grown up in a world of instant gratification. You want to buy something, you go on Amazon, it arrives the next day. You want to watch a movie? Log on and watch a movie. You don't check movie times. You want to watch a TV show? Binge. You don't even have to wait week to week to week. Right? I know people who skip seasons just so they can binge at the end of the season. Right? Instant gratification. You want to go on a date? You don't even have to learn how to be like, hey. You don't even have to learn and practice that skill. You don't have to be the uncomfortable one who says yes when you mean no and says no when you mean no and yes when you... You don't have to... Swipe right. Bang, I'm a stud. Right? You don't have to learn the social coping mechanisms. Right? Everything you want, you can have instantaneously. Everything you want, instant gratification. Except job satisfaction and strength of relationships, there ain't no app for that. They are slow, meandering, uncomfortable, messy processes. And so I keep meeting these wonderful, fantastic, idealistic, hardworking, smart kids. They've just graduated school. They're in their entry-level job. And I sit down with them and I go, how's it going? They go, I think I'm going to quit. I'm like, why? They're like, I'm not making an impact. I'm like, you've been here 8 months. You know? It's as if they're standing at the foot of a mountain. And they have this abstract concept called impact that they want to have in the world, which is the summit. What they don't see is the mountain. I don't care if you go up the mountain quickly or slowly, but there's still a mountain. And so what this young generation needs to learn is patience. That some things that really, really matter, like love or job fulfillment, joy, love of life, self-confidence, a skill set, any of these things, all of these things take time. Sometimes you can expedite pieces of it, but the overall journey is arduous and long and difficult. And if you don't ask for help and learn that skill set, you will fall off the mountain. The worst case scenario, and we're already seeing it, the worst case scenario is we're seeing an increase in suicide rates. We're seeing an increase in this generation. We're seeing an increase in accidental deaths due to drug overdoses. We're seeing more and more kids drop out of school or take leaves of absence due to depression. Unheard of. This is really bad. The best case scenario, those are all bad cases, right? The best case scenario is you'll have an entire population growing up and going through life and just never really finding joy. They'll never really find deep, deep fulfillment in work or in life. They'll just waft through life and it'll be just, it's fine. How's your job? It's fine. The same as yesterday. How's your relationship? It's fine. Like, that's the best case scenario. Which leads me to the fourth point, which is environment. Which is, we're taking this amazing group of young, fantastic kids who are just dealt a bad hand. It's no fault of their own. And we put them in corporate environments that care more about the numbers than they do about the kids. They care more about the short-term gains than the long-term life of this young human being. We care more about the year than the lifetime, right? And so we are putting them in corporate environments that aren't helping them build their confidence, that aren't helping them learn the skills of cooperation, that aren't helping them overcome the challenges of a digital world and finding more balance, that isn't helping them overcome the need to have instant gratification and teach them the joys and impact and the fulfillment you get from working hard over on something for a long time that cannot be done in a month or even in a year. And so we're thrusting to them in corporate environments, and the worst part about it is they think it's them. They blame themselves. They think it's them who can't deal. And so it makes it all worse. It's not. I'm here to tell them it's not them. It's the corporations. It's the corporate environments. It's the total lack of good leadership in our world today that is making them feel the way they do. They were dealt a bad hand, and I hate to say it, but it's the company's responsibility. Sucks to be you. Like, we have no choice, right? This is what we got, and I wish that society and their parents did a better job. They didn't. So we're getting them in our companies, and we now have to pick up the slack. We have to work extra hard.
We're going to leave it there. We're going to have a part two for about 20 minutes on an upcoming show about what responsibility do the parents of the millennials have for creating the beliefs, the attitudes that then the millennials accept as real until they get into the real world and are not. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. In this segment of our program, dealing with relevant issues that impact all of us, we have on the line Professor Mary Holland. She is director of the Graduate Legal Skills Program at New York University School of Law. She specializes in international human rights, public law, and vaccine safety law, and injury compensation. Mary has also had a son who regressed into autism following the MMR vaccine. Mary has degrees from Harvard University, graduate degrees in international relations, and a doctor of jurisprudence from Columbia University. She's also taught international law at its law school, and Mary has co-authored Vaccine Epidemic, How Corporate Greed, Bias Science, and Coercive Government Threaten Our Human Rights, Our Health, and Our Children. And her website is vaccineepidemic.com. Nice to have you with us, Mary.
Thank you.
Mary, this past week, while many of us were outside demonstrating in front of New York University Medical Center, where there were some speakers, and one of the speakers was the medical doctor who helped be the guiding force for the mandatory vaccine laws in California, Dr. Pam. But also joining him is probably the most popular of the orthodox pro-vaccine advocates, Dr. Paul Offit. So while we were outside and could not get in, you were inside. And I would like for you to tell us about what strategies Offit and Penn are teaching to counter the anti-vaccine groups, which are growing in number, and they're growing in acceptance. I remember, I remember no one was paying attention to the vaccine injured parents 20 years ago, 30 years ago, but today they are. So take us exactly what happened inside, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a panel discussion called "Confronting Vaccine Resistance: Strategies for Success," And as you suggest, Dr. Pan, who was who's a doctor and was the key legislator in California to eradicate all non-medical exemptions, he was the lead speaker. But also there were Dr. Paul Offit, Dorit Rubenstein Rice, Arthur Kaplan, who's at NYU Medical School, Dr. Bernard Dreyer, who's at NYU and president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and two other physicians at NYU, or two other people at the medical school. And the audience was largely medical students and physicians and other people in the NYU medical school community and a few friends of that community. And I felt very fortunate to be able to attend, I think primarily as an NYU faculty member. The irony to me, Gary, is I don't think they confronted vaccine resistance at all. They were teaching how to coerce compliance with vaccine mandates, and they were teaching how to achieve more vaccine mandates, and that is their objective, to eradicate all non-medical exemptions, to question any physician who would grant a medical exemption or endorse one, and basically to have everybody comply with the CDC's current schedule for childhood vaccinations. And the doctor who's head of the American Academy of Pediatrics went out of his way to say there is only one valid schedule. Any doctor who varies from the schedule is really somebody who should be censored. So they emphasized, getting people to comply and coercing them to comply. Obviously, the law in California is very coercive. No child can go to a public or private school should that child not be in full compliance with California's schedule. And they make it extremely difficult for doctors to grant medical exemptions. So there was a particular role at this panel discussion to excoriate Dr. Robert Sears, who has stood up for medical exemptions and stood up for the premise that not every child is the same and a vaccine schedule for one is not necessarily good for another. What else did they do? They talked about how really helpful the measles outbreak had been in Disneyland. Some of the participants said, thank God for the measles outbreak at Disneyland, that they thought really brought home to people the tremendous risk posed by what they characterized as deadly diseases. So they were very happy that the outbreaks now suggest the need for mandates. They were very engaged in vilification of people who assert the right to make their own medical decisions. So they vilified yet again Dr. Andrew Wakefield, but Dr. Sears, National Vaccine Information Center, Robert Kennedy, all of the sort of prominent speakers who've spoken out about choice. They also characterize all of these people as anti-vaccine, which they absolutely know is an inaccurate characterization. And then Dr. Pan in particular kind of walked through how he had a winning strategy in California, and he was lionized. Everybody talked about him as a hero. They talked about Dr. Offit as a hero. And I thought one of the most interesting things that Dr. Pan had to say, and something very important for people who are listening who want to stand up to these kind of mandates, is he suggested that it was critical in California that there was no review of SB 277 in appropriations committees. They characterize this law, I imagine inaccurately, but they characterize it as having no financial implications. So clearly one strategy to combat these kinds of laws, which they clearly intend to push out around the country, is to insist that the financial dimensions be reviewed.
Okay. I'm going to play a clip here in a moment. It is not a good quality audio clip because it was of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recently speaking about his conversation with Paul Offit and how what he and Offit said together is completely different than what Offit then later said on NPR, totally contradicting him. And also, I don't know if you're aware of it, but there's a piece up on the internet about Offit being approached by a parent who was very polite, just wanted to get a point when Offit was waiting before he went up, and often told him to go F himself, you know, or get, or to go F out of here, or something like that. Very vulgar. Unnecessary. After all, this is a person whose child had suffered because of this, and it showed a very inappropriate, discourteous way of dealing with this. In any case, I want to play this clip for you. But before we play it, I also want to mention this, that I told the group outside that my concern is that we're asking the wrong questions and we'll never win. And we're asking the wrong questions in part because people have not done the depth of the homework in the area they should have, including Robert F. Kennedy, who I respect for the good work he has done on this, and many others, including Andrew Wakefield. And I said, to this day, Wakefield is still pro-vaccine. I said it was only after I spent years studying vaccine science, including the toxicological reports, that I started to see that we shouldn't start off by the idea that vaccines are safe and effective, but we just want to make sure they're all safer instead of that one hot lot that will end up impacting some small, tiny percentage of children. But as Offit has said so many times, it's certainly worth it if you have a couple children who are injured because of a bad vaccine. Think of the greater good with all those millions of children who are saved and protected. And if we didn't have these vaccines, we'd have an epidemic of modern infectious diseases. And so after 14,000 hours of scholarship on the subject, and after speaking with Suzanne Humphreys and Dr. Nancy Banks and Tony Bark, all of whom spent between 10,000 to 15,000 hours in their own research, we all came to the same decision, that there is no good science that we could use to prove that any given vaccines or combination vaccines is safe or effective in any given individual, and that science hasn't been confirmed because the research hasn't been confirmed. And then on top of that, the indemnification, holding harmless the vaccine makers. So if they do injure people, it'll never be determined they are at fault because the vaccine injury court takes care of it. They don't. Their reputation is never solid. And so I said, why don't you all start by looking at the actual science? And I gave some examples that I was able to find over 1,000 studies in peer-reviewed literature on aluminum and at aluminum as a neurotoxin and what it does in the body at any part per billion, mercury the same, but also some of the other ingredients. And then I gave them all a documentary that you're in, fact, Seeds of Death. I believe that we should start to broaden the question or they'll continue the argument, well, we're doing better at finding safer vaccines instead of prove to me that these vaccines right. actually work. And that's where the argument has not been driven. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, I just wanted to share that.
Yeah. I mean, they believe their own they believe their own sales pitch, which is that these products are safe and effective, and yet that's obviously not the case. As a legal matter, these are unavoidably unsafe prescription medications that have liability protection.
And that's where I believe our next major battle should be in really educating the parents of injured vaccine children, that pull back the curtain a little further, and
right.
you'll see a whole lot of science that has
right.
you've taken for granted, or you've been told is there, in point of fact, it isn't. Now let's hear what, again, I apologize because this was a person in the audience recording over, I guess, their cell phone, Robert Kennedy Jr., but I thought it was of value since we're talking about Paul Offit. Let's hear Robert Kennedy mm-hmm. now.
Oh, I did what I do on any environmental case. I called people up on the phone. I called the people who were defending the vaccines. I reported those phone calls on a tape recorder, which is legal in New York State. People say, oh, you recorded the phone calls, that's horrible. But I record phone calls all the time because I'm dealing with bad people constantly in my life. So I record them, and then when they lie, I can say, well, I actually have you saying that on tape recording. Well, that's what I did. So I called Fareed McCormick, and I called Kathleen Stratton, and I called Paul Offit. And, you know, it was made up. I have earned $29 million working with the vaccine industry at minimum. And that's why they call him Dr. Profit. And he was the better. And I'll tell you what was something interesting is that in all these conversations, these people were so nice to me that I felt bad because all of them said, you know, I got into public health because of your father. He inspired me to give my life in public service. And I believe they genuinely meant that. But at some time during their careers, they got sucked into this vortex of corruption. And they started lying. And that's what happens sometimes with public officials. So I got on the phone, call off, and I, you know, the stuff they said to me is very interesting, and I recorded and transcribed it, and you'll get a chance to read it if you want. For any of you who want, I'm going to talk about this document that we've now created. But I talked to Paul off on the telephone, and he said to me, "Well, you see, Bobby, there is no connection because there really isn't an autism epidemic." And I said to him, "Oh, what about the Axel study and what about the CDC study that says it actually is?" He said, "Oh yeah, well, why don't you write about that?" He said, "But the real problem is that azithromycin is not persistent in the body." And I said, "Well, what about the Rohrabacher study?" And he went, "Oh yeah." And he said, "Well, the real reason is that the data studies show that there's no connection." And I said, "Well, here's what happened in Denmark. And plus, in the vaccine court, this had happened just shortly before I had my conversation with him at the drug industry's vaccine industry's own expert in the vaccine court in Texas in trial. Said that the Danish study was worthless, bogus science. Their own expert." Yeah. So because they cross-examined them and showed all of the fraud that was attached to that. That was like tobacco science. It wasn't even good tobacco science. It was, you know, the Tobacco Institute, which defended the tobacco industry for all those years, they would never put out something that was that amateurish and patently fraudulent. So he said, I said to him, you know, well, here's what they did. And he went, "Yeah, well, you may be right about that." But it's the accumulation of all of the evidence together that makes it so that Chimerosal is safe. Which, I at that point, he had said so many lies to me that I didn't even call him on that. But the answer to that is 3 times 0 is 0. Right? So, and I thought, okay, I'm glad because I just educated this guy. Now he won't say this stuff again. Well, then 2 weeks later, I heard him on the radio, on NPR, and he said, "There's nothing to do between Chimerosal and autism because, first of all, there is no such thing as an autism epidemic. It's an artifact of better diagnostic techniques, plus we have a data study that says, that proves that when you remove Chimerosal, autism goes up and down, etc." So he said all the things that he admitted to me were lies, but he repeated them. And at that moment, I knew that he was lying and that he was deliberately lying.
Okay, Mary, you get the gist there that I do not believe that it will do any good at all confronting the Paul Offits or the pro-vaccine people. They have a right to their opinion, whether that opinion is right and based upon sound science or simply self-interest based upon how much money they make. They alone know. We will never know. But we do know that the studies that they have used to claim that the mercury is safe don't exist. We have the studies that do that are from independent science. There's over 1,000 studies that I have collected from independent journals over a 30-year period, by the way, showing mercury in any amount is toxic. And then we also have the proof that the man who was given the money by the CDC to do these so-called studies on the relationship of vaccines and autism, is now a fugitive from justice. And therefore, those studies cannot be accepted as valid. And we also then have the recorded conversations between Dr. Thompson, William Thompson, who was one of the overseers of the study on the MMR vaccine, and found that there was over a 324% increase in autism spectrum conditions in 36-month-old or younger African-American boys. No matter how they tried to fudge the material, they couldn't change it. And so therefore, they decided to destroy everything by putting all that information in black bags. He felt some sense of responsibility, so he kept a copy. Then began this whole mea culpa confession to Brian Hooker, Dr. Brian Hooker, and Hooker came forward with that information. So when you look at the totality of the evidence is clear that they don't have good science on their side, but they have the power of the FDA, the power of the CDC, the power of the National Institutes of Health, and the power of corporate media to not go in there and do their own original investigative report. I've yet to see the New York Times or CNN or any of these other institutions who have the resources and capability of doing that research to go in and talk with Dr. Thompson, to look at all those thousands of pages that Brian Hooker has, to talk with the Florida legislator who Dr. Thompson spoke with and who has all those documents showing corruption, collusion, malfeasance at the CDC. And yet no one does this. Your thoughts, please.
In a plug for a book that's just come out by Dr. James Lyons Weiler called The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism, and it reviews 2,000 scientific papers and comes to the absolute conclusion that the same mechanism that Dr. Offit would agree causes autism in the first trimester from poisonous heavy metals and other toxic exposures, it does the same thing after birth, particularly mercury and aluminum. So we do have the science on our side. And one of the things that was so striking about this panel discussion, Gary, is these people are not self-reflective. They don't say, gee, you know, maybe this vaccine is different than others, or gee, who are these people across the street who would be standing out in frigid cold protesting us? There's no self-reflection, which is, you know, that's just not consistent with sort of intellectual integrity. It's hard to, as you say, we'll never know what their true motivations are, but they certainly are not willing to confront resistance. They really are all about coercion at this point.
Well, as long as we continue to protest, but I believe that we have to have a whole new beginning. And I'm advocating that those who've done the homework on the actual safety and efficacy, including numerous toxicologists who've never been interviewed by anyone, and numerous immunologists who've never been interviewed by anyone, and to bring them into the discussion to show the true independent literature so that we can start with the right question.
Right.
And if we don't start with the right question, they have too much power.
Gary, I agree with you, but I think their strategy is clearly not a science-based strategy, and they believe, based on the conversation on Monday, that momentum is on their side, quote-unquote, and what they are going to be doing in this spring, as they did 2 years ago in 2015, is to have lobbyists pay money to introduce legislation to eradicate all non-medical exemptions. So certainly we have to emphasize the science, but also I think people who insist on choice here need to be standing up for doctors who give medical exemptions and standing up for religious exemptions and for personal belief exemptions. I think that there is going to be likely another coordinated effort to eradicate non-medical exemptions across the country on a state-by-state basis.
I absolutely agree with you. We have to have multiple approaches,
right,
depending upon a person's skill, expertise, and their access and their sustainability of that energy. You can't just go out to one
Absolutely.
Demonstration, write yeah. one protest letter, because these people, once they hire a PR firm and they have lobbyists, they have deep pockets. And their PR programs, they realize in time, can beat back the truth.
They can. But one of the things that was very impressive about the discussion on Monday is how seriously they take the opposition, how frazzled they were and how upset and uncomfortable that the vaxxed bus was parked across from the medical school, that 100 people were standing out in the cold. It rattled them deeply. As you saw, Dr. Offit, I think, is quite thin-skinned, but he was really out of his, you know, he was just completely inappropriate to this person who approached him politely in an open public area. So the protests work. Sort of people in California making the case that this is a decision between individuals and their physician. I mean, it made a huge difference. I think, you know, for the time being, Dr. Pan won in California, but it doesn't have to remain that way. And I think there was also concern that the atmosphere in the country may now be different. I think President-elect Trump, who has, you know, many other issues we could talk about, but on the issue of vaccines, he is on the record saying that he thinks it's too many too soon and that they're toxic and that they can cause autism. So I think it's a very different atmosphere at a federal level than might have been the case otherwise.
I agree. Well, Mary, thank you for being on, and thank you for sharing the insight of what occurred there. And I will keep you posted on a brand new documentary that we have coming out, focused exclusively upon the science, to share with those who are advocates of the... And that information will come shortly. We're out of time, everyone. I want to thank you for taking your time today to listen in. Remember, Cinema Arts Center on Sunday at noon for premiere. And go to my Facebook page. You can watch the documentary, or not the watch the film footage of the demonstration against the pro-vaccine advocates at the New York University Medical School last week. Have a nice day, everyone.